Today is a great pleasure to have Shalinka Gordage from Monash University to give the strong gravity seminar. I think the talk title is binary black hole spin distribution, the emerging picture from gravitational wave astronomy. Yeah, Shalinka, please take it away.
So thank you for the invitation to talk to this group today. Yes, my name is Shalinka. I'm a third year PhD student at Monash University, which also means I'm in my final year, given it's an Australian PhD. And I'm a member of the LIGO collaboration as well as OSGRAV. So today I'll be talking to you about what we can learn about the binary black hole spin distribution from gravitational wave astronomy. So first off, starting with a bit of background. So gravitational waves, we're able to, well, so far we've detected gravitational waves from sources that are compact binary mergers. And these gravitational waves, we can get information about the binary system that went on to merge. So if you've got two binary black holes, for example, you can get information about their masses, their spins, their orientation of their spin with respect to the orbital angular momentum. So these are some examples of their intrinsic parameters. And then you've got things such as how far away the source is and the inclination of the orbital plane. And these are some of the extrinsic parameters. So there are 15 parameters for binary black hole mergers that you can get. And this is excluding eccentricity. And with binary neutron stars, for example, you have a few more parameters that take into account the tidal deformability of these systems. So with each of these events, we're able to extract information about their masses, spins, and redshifts using things such as parameter estimation and Bayesian inference to be able to extract these parameters from the gravitational waves signal. And so I'm going to wind back the clock a little bit to the end of 2020 when LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra came out with their second transient catalog. So here you might be familiar with a variation of this plot. This is the stellar graveyard. And I've made a variation of this plot that shows just the LIGO, Virgo, Kagra black holes. So every blue dot represents a black hole. And I think gravitational wave events are pretty great because you get three black holes for the price of one event. And so this particular plot is showing the events that we got from the first, second, and third observation, or the first half of the third observation run for LIGO and Virgo. And moving to the end of 2021, this catalog grew, including the events from O3B. And as you can see, there's a pretty significant increase. And we have over 90 compact binaries now that we have properties of. And so like with any kind of population, when you have a lot of events, you can start to ask questions about the general trends in the population. And so with these analyses, you can start to answer questions such as, how massive are the most massive black holes in these distributions? How are these black holes spinning? Are they maximally spinning? Are they generally low spins? Do they generally have low spins? And even which way they're oriented, and what can that tell us about stellar evolution and binary formation? So I've been quite lucky in my PhD to have been involved in some of the population studies of LIGO and Virgo, in particular, the last two population studies that we've done. So at the end of 2020, we did a population analysis of GWTC2, which includes the first, second, and the first half of the third observing run. And in our analyses, I've written up here the numbers of binary black holes that we actually analyzed. Our catalogs are actually larger than these values. We use a subset of these events for our population studies because we want to use the events that we're confident about to be binary black holes. And so for GWTC2, we use 44 events. And in GWTC3, we use 69 events, including O3b. And with these population studies, we have models for the masses, the spins, and the redshifts. And we try to extract the general distribution of these populations using models that we have developed based on some predictions from astrophysics. So these population analyses did look at mass spin and redshift, but for this talk, I will be focusing on just the spin distribution of binary black holes. So why do we care about the spin distribution of binary black holes? So the spin distributions, by looking at the spin magnitudes and orientations, can tell us information about how these binary black holes formed and how they evolve. And before I get into the details about these different channels that you can form binary black holes, I would like to give you a bit of an overview of some of the parameterizations that you'll generally come across with gravitational wave analyses. So the first one is physical spin quantities, and the second one is in effective spin quantities. So when I talk about physical spin quantities, what I mean is when you look at a binary black hole system, you have their spin vectors as well as the, by the way, can everyone see my pointer?
Yes.
Awesome, thanks. So you have these theta values. So this is the angle of the tilt with respect to the orbital angular momentum vector given by this white arrow here. And so I'll also highlight here that these, we sort these binaries by their masses. So we say the primary black hole is the more massive one, secondary being the less massive one. And so in this work that I'll be showing, we use these black holes sorted by their masses. There is some work that looks at what happens to the population when you sort the mass, the binary black holes by their spins instead. So ordering them by more rapidly spinning versus less rapidly spinning. And if you're interested in that work, check out Sylvia's work. I've linked the archive link here. But with our physical quantities, we can get the spins of each component and the orientation of each component. For the effective spin parameters, they're a little bit more complicated, but I would like to walk you through these. So on the left-hand side, we have the effective n-spiral spin parameter, chi effective. All you really need to know here is that this is the spin that's projected along the orbital angular momentum, and it's weighted by the masses of the binary. Whereas the effective precession spin parameter, or chi p, is the spin projected in the plane of the orbit, and this is also weighted by the masses of the binary. And so chi effective is a parameter that we really like in gravitational waveland because it tends to be a better measured parameter compared to the other parameters we measure. And it is a conserved quantity over the evolution of the binary. And in terms of chi p, this is a parameter that we use to measure, was a measure of orbital precession, hence the name effective precession spin parameter. And so if you have in-plane spins of a binary, you're going to have orbital precession of the binary. I will note here that if you work in chi effective and chi p space, you do lose some information because you can't go from chi effective and chi p back to your physical spin quantities because there are too many degrees of freedom. So you do need to define some additional parameters to be able to go back to those parameters. And I'll also note that it's important to take care when you use chi effective and chi p space, when you develop your models, or if you use them for your initial analysis of binary black hole systems and initial parameter estimation. And the reason for that is any kind of distributions you use there, if you try and map it back to physical spin quantities, you need to make sure that they are in moderate agreement, at least, of what you would expect astrophysically. I have a few examples of that, but I'll probably leave that for later. So these are the general parameterizations that we have for the spin distributions of binary black holes. And so I'll be bringing up these parameters a few times. So I mentioned that we can learn more about the spin distributions and by studying the population, but we can also probe how these binaries form by looking at the spin distribution. And so the two main channels that we look at in our gravitational wave analyses are the isolated and the dynamical channel or formations for binary black holes. So just a brief overview of what the isolated channel is. You have a stellar binary that's living their lives together. These purple arrows are showing the spin vectors. The white arrow is showing the orbital angular momentum of the binary. And as this binary evolves, you have these tidal effects that align the spin vectors more with the orbital angular momentum. So these tidal effects can include when this stellar binary undergoes a common envelope phase, for example. And as this binary evolves, eventually one of them will undergo a core collapse supernova and collapse down into a black hole. This supernova imparts a kick to the secondary, which can misalign the secondary a little bit, but this is not so great that it completely disrupts the binary, just misaligns it slightly. And so you form your first black hole, and eventually the secondary will also collapse down into a black hole, and you end up with a binary black hole system. In the dynamical case, this can happen in environments such as globular clusters, where you have many-body interactions. So in a globular cluster, if you have a bunch of black holes, they're going to fall towards the center of the globular cluster because they're massive. And so you can have many black holes interacting with each other. And eventually, you'll have an interaction where two black holes can capture each other and form a black hole binary. And so in this scenario, you just have these randomly oriented black holes, and they go on to form a binary. And so they just have random orientations when they form this binary. I'll note that one of the things that people look for when they try to find evidence of the dynamical channel is what we call hierarchical mergers. So hierarchical mergers are where you have black holes that have merged but then merged again. So in this case, you have black holes that are becoming more massive. So as you merge, you create more massive black holes. But because you also merge these black holes and you have the orbital angular momentum of the binary, you end up with rapidly spinning remnants as well. And so this can be up to about 70% of the speed of light. And so essentially, if you have hierarchical mergers, you have more massive black holes that are also more rapidly spinning. And so this is something that folks look for evidence of dynamical assembly. And so for more information about this, see Chase Kimball's work. But in this scenario, we can also just look at the spin distribution of binary black holes in order to look at these two different channels. So the question now is, how can we map what we see in the isolated and dynamical channel from astrophysics to our gravitational wave observations and our models to be able to go, okay, we've seen evidence for one or the other? So let's take a look at how we can draw a model that could represent these two channels. So if you have a bunch of binary black holes that are preferentially aligned with the orbital angular momentum, you would expect the cosine of the angle to be close to one. But it wouldn't be a delta function. You would expect some misalignment. So probably an appropriate model would be to use a truncated Gaussian that's peaked at one. Great. Another thing that we need to consider is this dynamical channel. So here, these binaries have random orientations, so there's no reason why they have to be aligned or misaligned or anything. So you just have an isotropic distribution of spin orientations, which is the same as having a uniform distribution in the cosine of theta. So we have some uniform distribution. And so you can have a model that looks at the fraction of binaries in this first component versus the second component. And so our overall population could look something like this if we have both. So this is an example of how we map what we would expect from the astrophysics to our models that we use to analyze our gravitational wave population. So some of the models, so a bit about some of the models that we used in the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra analysis of the spin distribution of binary black holes. So there were two spin models used, one called the default model, which used the physical spin quantity parameterization, and the second model called the Gaussian model. So the Gaussian model, pretty much the name explains what it is. So, and it's in the effective spin quantity parameter space. It essentially used a Gaussian for both chi effective and chi p with some correlation parameter. I won't be talking about the Gaussian model too much in this talk. I'll be focusing on the default model. And one of the reasons for that is both models gave qualitatively similar results for the population following GWTC2. So for the default model, what we use is on the left-hand side here, we have the spin magnitude model. And this is an example of a beta distribution. So our distribution for spin magnitudes goes from 0 to 1. And on the right here, this is the same model that I drew before, where we have a combination of a truncated distribution, a Gaussian, and a uniform distribution in cos theta. And so those are our models for the default model. And so using these models, we can analyze the gravitational wave population. And that's exactly what we did following GWTC2. And these are the results that we saw. So we have on the left here, the spin magnitude distribution. So here we have, essentially we prefer to have binaries that are less rapidly spinning than maximally spinning. We don't have preference for maximally spinning black holes, which is kind of what we expect from theory. And on the right-hand side, we have the cosine of the tilt angle, the distribution for that. And you can see here that we have a preference for more aligned systems, but we also have support for more misaligned systems. I should add that the solid curve represents the mean of the distribution and the dashed lines represent the 90% gradable interval. So if we take a closer look at the right-hand side plot, so we have a preference for aligned systems, but support for misaligned systems. So this is suggestive that we might have evidence for both channels, both the isolated and the dynamical formation channel. If we combine these two distributions, we can get a distribution for the chi effective distribution. And that's what we can do here. So the solid curves here represent the mean, shaded regions represent the 90% gradable interval. And this shows the chi effective distribution for both population models that we used. So positive chi effective values mean that your binary is within 90 degrees of the orbital, tilted within 90 degrees of the orbital angular momentum. And negative values means you're tilted more than 90 degrees with respect to the orbital angular momentum. And so the assumption that we use is that it's pretty hard to create very tilted systems via the isolated channels. So this is likely evidence for dynamical formation. So what we say is if we have support for negative values of chi effective, that is evidence for dynamical formation. And so in these results, in the GWTC2 results, what we found was that we do have support for negative chi effective values. I also want to highlight a few things here. So really positive values of chi effective means that you're more aligned with the orbital angular momentum and you're close to maximally spinning, and negative values means you're almost perfectly misaligned and also very rapidly spinning. The pictorial I have in the center here is showing a binary black hole that's not spinning. That is an option that you have when you have chi effective equals zero. But this could also mean that your binaries are well pointed in the plane. So if you're tilted 90 degrees with respect to the orbital angular momentum, you can also get a chi effective of zero. So this is where the interpretation of chi effective can become a bit difficult because you have two pieces of information in the same set of data. So this is what we saw following GWTC2.
Sorry, what does this default mean and Gaussian mean here?
So the default and Gaussian represent the population models that we used. So they're just the names for the different population models. The default model was the physical spin component one, and the Gaussian model was the model that was looking at the effective spin parameter space. So it used a Gaussian for chi effective and a Gaussian for chi p to create this distribution.
And what do you, and what prior did you use for constructing this this result?
So for the default model, like the prior distribution or the population prior is a beta distribution, and the population or the parameters, sorry, we use uniform priors in each of our hyperparameters. So backtracking a little bit, to get our beta distribution, what we describe the population using hyperparameters, which describe the shape of the beta distribution. So the priors we use on each population parameter is a uniform distribution.
Okay.
So so this is what we got for the chi-effective distribution. And so that's what we had following GWTC2 for the LVK analysis. However, this is where the story gets interesting. There was a conflicting picture arising from additional analyses by independent groups. So from the LVK analysis of GWTC2, the spin models found support for a subpopulation of binaries with negative chi-effective values. However, a study led by Javier Roulet et al, they didn't find this evidence for negative chi-effective values. They dispute this finding. So this is a problem because if you analyze the same set of data, or at least really similar sets of data, you should be drawing the same conclusions. However, one study was finding evidence for negative chi-effective, which suggests that you both have both isolated and dynamical formation. However, the Roulet et al. Study seems to show that the population is fully consistent with the isolated channel. So we wanted to attempt to resolve this conflict between these two studies. And so we reanalyzed the GWTC2 population with a more flexible model. And we wanted to determine how sensitive our results would be to any assumptions we make about the shape of our population models. So one of the first things to do, however, and this is following a process that was used in the Roulet et al. Study, is to look at our event posteriors. So on the right-hand side, I have a plot here, which the labels are quite small, because I tried to fit in all the events, all 44 events here. However, so on the x-axis here, I have chi-effective. And so chi-effective of zero means either you're non-spinning or you're perfectly in the plane. And so what we're finding here is if we just look at the black dots and the error bars on those black dots, all of these events are consistent with chi-effective equals zero or greater than zero, because all of these events up to here overlap zero, and then you've got a few that are well into the positive side of the distribution. What this seems to suggest is that perhaps the subpopulation of binaries that we saw with negative chi-effective in the LVK analysis is likely a result of model misspecification. So potentially, our population models weren't flexible enough to be able to capture these events that are near zero, chi-effective of zero. There's also a theoretical motivation to wanting to capture a subpopulation at zero. So theoretical studies of angular momentum transport in stars show that if black holes should be born spinning pretty slowly. And so this would also mean that when you see merging binary black holes, they should merge with negligible spin. And so the LVK analysis models, particularly the default model, didn't have the flexibility to account for this subpopulation. So we account for this. We adapt our models to be able to account for chi equals zero. So there's a bunch of equations on this slide, but let me walk you through this. So the pink represents, what I've highlighted in pink here, represents the population models, the default population model. And the pictures on the side kind of represent an example of a population model for this distribution. So we have a beta distribution, and essentially what we do to account for a zero spin subpopulation is add a delta function at zero. And this lambda naught parameter is a parameter that measures the fraction of binaries in the delta function. And so one minus lambda measures the fraction of binaries in this beta distribution. So essentially it's a parameter that measures the fraction of non-spinning binary black holes. We also made a slight modification to our spin orientation model. So here I have, before, this is the same plot as before, there's a little pictorial on the bottom. However, so the default model forces the distribution to start and end at negative one and one. So because we have a uniform distribution that extends across the entire parameter space. However, we wanted to see if the data prefers to end a little bit earlier. So here, this blue diagram is just showing you that the distribution can cut off a little bit earlier, and that's what this Z min is referring to. So this minimum Z is no longer fixed at negative one, it can vary. And so this does change the description of our model a little bit in terms of the astrophysics. So we no longer have a uniform distribution, which we can really say is from the dynamical channel. But this is really introduced as a test to see if we are artificially trying to force our population to have spins that are more misaligned than it needs. So these were the slight modifications that we made to our population models in order to analyze GWTC2 with a more flexible model to account for this zero spin subpopulation.
Shanika, do you mind if I ask a question?
Absolutely.
So can you explain why the beta distribution is a good idea for chi1 and chi2?
That's a great question. I'm not sure it is a good idea anymore, at least. So when these models were introduced a few years back, we used it because it's pretty good at kind of capturing any kind of distribution that starts at zero, ends at one. And we've restricted it so that it can only kind of start at the axis and end at the axis. So for a beta distribution, we have these like alpha chi and beta chi values, and we restrict them to be greater than one. However, this beta distribution is pretty poor at capturing any kind of distributions that are very narrow around zero. So this introduction of a delta function was really necessary to capture that zero spin subpopulation. However, there's ongoing work to explore better models. In fact, a recent study by, I think in Chase's work actually, Chase Kimball, with the hierarchical merger study, they use a truncated Gaussian that can vary rather than a big distribution, which seems to be a better fit actually. So this work continues. So this work continues off the LVK analysis to see where those models were failing. But I think more work can be done to improve these models to be actually better capture these low spin distributions.
So I guess the basic question of my question, the basic version of that question is, you know, why not take uniform distributions? You're building a lot of knowledge into those distributions. And so is it justified to do that versus just doing the completely agnostic model where you don't know anything, therefore everything is, you know, uniform?
Great question. So with our initial parameter estimation, so when we analyze each individual event, we use uniform distributions in the spin orientations and the spin magnitudes. On this, when we do hierarchical inference and try to analyze the population, we're really trying to understand the astrophysics from these distributions. So using a uniform distribution is actually, like, we may think it's uninformative, but it's not really, because you're biasing your results to be more rapidly spinning when theory suggests that you wouldn't expect to see so many rapidly spinning binary black holes. In fact, you would prefer to have generally lower spinning binary black holes. And so these population studies are really trying to see how good of a fit essentially these population models are compared to the fiducial model, which is these uniform distributions that we use in our initial analysis of each event. So the goal behind these population models, or like my personal goal at least, and I think a lot of others are doing this too, is to use astrophysics theories to better inform our models so we can have a way to map what we're seeing to the astrophysics theories.
I think I can see the idea that you don't want to be completely uninformed, because you are somewhat informed, but you don't want to overweigh your poor information. So I think it's a sort of delicate balance between the two, right?
Yeah. And also I'll add to this that ideally, so when we use these uniform priors, they could be heavily biasing our kind of initial parameter estimation. For example, if we were to analyze events in chi effective, for example, and use a uniform distribution in chi effective, that can be problematic because it results in spin distributions, like physical parameter distributions, that are maximally spinning and perfectly aligned or perfectly misaligned. And so you want to use, like, what we do with these analyses is we can use the population results as our initial prior to analyze the an event. So for example, and I might be rambling here a little bit, but we use uniform mass distributions when we analyze each event, but when we study the population, we have some models that reflect what we expect from astrophysics. So some of the things that people model in is like a power law and a peak that represents pulsational, what you might expect if you have a parent stability, a cutoff and a pulsational parent stability peak, for example. And so you can use what you get from your population result as your prior again and reweight your distribution based on what you think the true distribution is. Ideally, what we want is our priors to be as close to reality as possible for our inference studies. So it may seem like we are, I guess, including too much astrophysics and not being as uninformative as possible. But the goal is, like, even if you use a uniform prior, you could be just biasing your results away from reality to begin with.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But it's a little bit of a delicate, you know, circular thing. So anyway, I should let you go on. Thank you.
That's totally fine.
I saw Reed had the question. Reed, do you still have the question?
No, I was just going to say, Eric, that the distributions that Shanika has shown here, the uniform distributions are limiting cases. So if you futz with the parameters for the population model, you can get a flat distribution on the spins. So if the data likes a flat distribution on the spins, Shanika's analysis will tell you that. Like, he's trying to figure out the distribution of spins, not like what the spin is of event one versus event two. Like, really, she's doing all of it together, which is super cool. But yeah, so she's trying to learn whether the distribution is uniform or not.
Didn't realize that. So yeah, thank you. Thank you, very nice.
Thanks for clarifying that, Reed. I didn't realize that I was missing that piece of information. But yes, I'm trying to work out the shape of the distribution rather than analyzing an individual event with a certain fixed astrophysical distribution. Cool. So just to recap quickly, so here I have, we've just introduced a delta function to capture these low spinning events. And we've just added this cutoff in Z min. Cutoff in Z are called Z min to be able to see if our population prefers to cut off at earlier misalignment, so it's the population's not as misaligned. So when we analyze the GWTC2 population with these updated models, this is what we get. So first of all, when I say this is what we get, this is what we get for the lambda naught fraction. So here is a distribution on the fraction of binaries in the zero spin peak. And so the distribution here is peaking at around 0.5-ish and excludes 0 and 1. So what this means is that we have evidence, or our data supports this evidence for a zero spin subpopulation. And if you take the 90% credible intervals, they're actually quite broad. So anywhere between 29 to 75% of binaries have negligible spin. But this is quite interesting because this is not, we couldn't see this subpopulation with our original analysis. So this is quite exciting. Moving on to the Zmin parameter. So I'm just showing the parameters that we've introduced in this new model. Before, the default model forces Zmin to be -1 all the time. However, when you allow it to decide where it wants to best fit, Zmin decides to be peaking at around -0.3. But the interesting thing here is that you have a lot of support for Zmin equals zero. So what this means is, if Zmin equals zero, it means that your minimum misalignment is 90 degrees, which means you don't have evidence for spins that are misaligned more than 90 degrees. So if we were to exclude zero and this support was all the way over here, that would be evidence for misaligned spins. And when I say misaligned, I mean greater than 90 degrees. But given that we have support at zero, we can't be confident that there's definitely support for misaligned spins. So this is in agreement with the study by Roulet et al., which found that there wasn't any clear evidence for negative chi-effective values. So you can think of things below zero, negative values of Zmin would mean that you have only, sorry, if you only have negative values of Zmin, then you would have clear support for misaligned spins. So we can use our hyperparameters to get our distributions, the population distributions for the spin magnitude and spin orientation. So this is what the spin magnitude looks like with our updated model. So the default model is in pink, the extended model is in blue, and solid curve, mean of the distribution, shaded region, 90% credible interval. And you can see that when you've introduced this zero spin peak, your spinning population prefers to move to higher values. So this seems to show that before, the pink distribution was doing its best to kind of capture both. But once we've introduced this flexibility to the model, it prefers to move the spinning population. The spinning population captures a higher region, and you've got the low spin population captured by the zero spin peak. And so this, just by looking at the spin magnitude distribution, we can see that there are two subpopulations, one that's got negligible spins and one that's fairly rapidly spinning. If we look at the spin orientation distribution, so here is where information about Zmin comes into play. So the pink distribution is the default model where we enforce Zmin to always equal -1. But if you let it cut off earlier, you get this blue distribution. And so you can see that we have majority of our support for preferentially aligned systems, meaning that it's more in line with the orbital angular momentum, and less support for more misaligned spins. And looking at this, and from the Zedmin posterior distribution, we know that we don't have clear support for these misaligned spins. But it's interesting that our population does prefer to cut off here. So again, just like before, we can use our spin orientation and spin magnitude distributions to look at our effective in-spiral spin parameter distribution, so chi effective. And so I think here is where you can really see how the added flexibility is allowing us to capture the population a lot better than we could before. So the pink distribution here is, again, the default model, blue being the extended model. And you can see that in the blue model, we have these more positive values of chi effective, but also this really sharp peak at zero. In fact, I had to cut off this plot quite low because this peak is off, way off to the top of the screen. But essentially, you can kind of see how the pink model was trying to fit both populations, but failing. And as a result, it was also overestimating how many of it, like what fraction of binaries are in this negative chi effective space. But with this updated model, we see that 54% of binaries are in this zero spin peak, and we have less than 2% of binaries that have chi effective values less than negative 0.1. So we can see the evidence for these two subpopulations quite distinctly with this plot.
I think Reid has a question or comment.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, Shenika, I was wondering if you don't mind, if you could comment on the evidence that the width of the small spin distribution is actually very small. You know what I mean? Is it like a delta spike, or is it like what is the evidence that that excess near zero is actually a very, very tight spike?
So the model that we use is actually a delta function. So we either have, so we're going to get a spike because we use a delta function distribution in our population model. So, and we do that by taking the evidence values from, if you do an analysis of your population, assuming that you're spinning and assuming that you're not spinning, and we compare the evidence values. And if you have a preference for the non-spinning one, then those samples are used. And if you have a preference for the spinning one, those other samples are used. But essentially where it falls into, like the reason we have, so again, the reason we have a spike is because we use a delta function, not because of anything else.
Right. So would it be fair to say that this spike appears so tall because of a prior assumption, and the data could be completely consistent with a much shorter spike with a wider standard deviation?
So absolutely. So this goes into a bit of background as to our investigation as to why we use the delta function. So when we analyze this population with just the spinning events, so like if you just use the spinning posterior samples, we find that it seems to be undersampled at very, very low values near zero. And so we needed to opt to use these non-spinning samples, which forces a delta function because you just have zero. And so if we had more samples at zero with our spinning samples, I would imagine that this peak would be less peaked, but you'd still have the same fraction of binaries within, say, like 0.05 and negative 0.05 in chi effective. Like you would expect to have quite a narrow distribution, but obviously not as peaked. But I think like with the implementation that we have, it's, we can't at the moment get a width to this peak, but there is, like, we're working on a way to essentially reweight our spinning samples to be able to get some sort of width to this distribution and try and measure a width of this peak, because that could be quite interesting as to what kind of range is allowed for these negligible spin subpopulations in terms of angular momentum transport. But yes, to answer your question, Reach, yes, this peak may be less peaky if we allow for a broader, slightly broader distribution, but currently our implementation, where it's at, we can't do that.
Okay, thanks.
Cool, so this is what we get for our chi-effective distribution. I hope I'm going okay for time. So to conclude this section of it, we find evidence for two subpopulations. So one is that we have merging binaries with negligible spin, and two, we have merging binaries that are rapidly spinning and preferentially aligned with the orbital angular momentum. We also find that the extended model is preferred over the default model by a factor of around over 3,000. So this is a significant preference for the extended model. We also found that there was no clear support for negative chi-effective, and that the population, when you look at just spin information, is consistent with the isolated channel. But I say, and I stress, when we only consider spin information for a reason, because if you look at certain events such as GW190521, this event is pretty difficult to explain via the isolated formation scenario. One of the reasons being that it shows evidence for eccentricity or being eccentric, and eccentricity is one of those things that you would expect in a dynamical assembly scenario rather than your isolated channel. So I did mention that I would talk a bit about GWTC3, but before I get into that, so to summarize what we found, essentially we agree with Rule 8L that the negative chi-effective is evidence of negative chi-effective in the LVK analysis is probably a model-dependent extrapolation, but it's important to stress here that it doesn't mean that we don't have evidence for negative chi-effective, it's just that we don't have clear evidence for negative chi-effective. We have majority of the population with negligible spin, with the remaining with spin magnitudes of around 0.45. More details, you can find the paper on archive. And if you wanted to use these population distributions or any of the things created to use any of the data used in these plots, you can find it at my GitHub. So in terms of GWTC3, we're looking into it right now. And this work is led by Hui Tong, who is a PhD student at Monash that I'm mentoring and whose advisor is my advisor, Eric Thrain. And we're looking at the GWTC3 population using the extended model and a few other investigations as well. There are two events of note in this population. So GW191109 tends to have a lot of posterior support for negative chi-effective values, and GW200129 seems to have a lot of posterior support for large chi-p values. So this is, I guess, these are more outliery compared to what we've seen before. So these are more extreme chi-effective values and extreme chi-p values than compared to what we saw in GWTC2. So we can expect these kind of events to shift our population results quite a bit. I've just made a little note here that these posterior distributions do tend to change depending on the waveform that was used to analyze these events. If you're interested in those details, please check out the GWTC3 catalog paper. So as promised, here are some preliminary results from GWTC3. So what we're seeing here is, so I have the 1D posterior distributions for each of these parameters, and these are just the 2D posterior distributions. So for lambda zero, we can see that the peak has shifted from about 0.5 to 0.2. So we have, rather than 50% of binaries in this negligible spin subpopulation, we have around 20%. We also see that the rapidly spinning subpopulation is less rapidly spinning on average. And I think most interestingly, this Z min parameter is now fully below zero, which means we have clear evidence for misaligned spins. And we can also, by taking these hyperparameter distributions, we can look at the population distributions for the spin magnitude and spin orientation. And these are preliminary results as well. And so as expected from that, the mean of the distribution shifting to lower values, we see that the beta distribution for GWTC2 versus GWTC3 is now it's much lower. And peaking at around 0.2. And for our spin orientation, we can see that there's less support for preferentially aligned systems and more significant support for more misaligned spin orientations. And again, sorry, the solid curve represents the mean and the shaded regions represent the 90% credible interval. And so these are preliminary results so far with GWTC3. So to conclude, so recent work painted a conflicting portrait of the merging binary black hole spin distribution. And our work improved on these models to try and account for predictions from theory that we expect merging binary black holes, some merging binary black holes to have negligible spin. We find that in both GWTC2 and GWTC3, we do have a subpopulation with negligible spin. Following updates from GWTC3, we seem to have clear evidence for misaligned spins, which is quite exciting. And this is ongoing work at the moment. There are a number of investigations by myself and a number of other colleagues on the spin distribution of binary black holes. So if you're interested, please stay tuned because there's probably a bunch of publications coming out within the next month or so. So thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, I will answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Shanika, for the very nice talk. Any additional questions? Maybe I can start. I mean, I think Reed also mentioned, I guess I'm a little bit confused. Since you are using this beta distribution for fitting this chi, right? So this variable chi, but this beta distribution is zero and chi is one. So if you have a uniform distribution, it cannot, right? Like how can a uniform distribution be fitted by a function that goes to zero at chi equal to one? I mean, maybe I'm missing something here.
Do you mean what is like?
So if the physical distribution is uniform, right, by definition, it means that at chi equals one, the density, probability density is non-zero. But if you're using this beta distribution for your fitting, and this beta distribution is always zero at chi equals one, I don't know how you can fit this uniform distribution.
So the uniform distribution is what we used in our initial analysis for each event. So that's a prior distribution that we use. The purpose of our population distribution is to see what is our best fit of all the events of our population. So we're not trying to have a uniform distribution for each event, if that's where the confusion is coming from.
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine what if the population, right, for the population, the underlying distribution is a uniform distribution, right? So if that's true, I mean, how can you justify that you are using a beta distribution to fit that?
So I think like with, I guess, any population study, we develop our models based, so I'll backtrack a bit here. So the population models so far are based under some assumptions of what we expect from astrophysics. So what we expect out there in the real world, from predictions from theorists, we just take them and essentially we're like, okay, they're not going to be maximally spinning. And the beta distribution is pretty good at fitting a distribution that is not going to, like, you can have the option of a very like low spin but tapering off to high spins. So the beta distribution, what I'm trying to do is using some assumptions from theory, fit and see if this is a good fit to our population.
Sorry, is there a theoretical argument saying that the probability density for near extremal rotating black hole is zero? I mean, I saw we have some of the X-ray binaries have the measurement indicated that the spin is near extremal. I mean,
so if we look at just our gravitational wave data, for example, so for the merging binary black holes that we see, particularly these kind of distributions, if we just look at what we've seen so far, and these were analyzed with each event is analyzed with a uniform prior, what we're generally seeing is lower spin, not maximally spinning events. And so this is, I think, a sensible assumption going forwards with, we don't expect to see binary black holes that are merging with maximal spins, generally speaking. I see Reed has a hand up.
Yeah, maybe just a point of mathematical clarification, Juan. The beta distribution basically looks like wherever your parameter is, so chi raised to some power, and it's bound, it's, then it's one minus whatever that thing is raised to some other power, and it's bounded between zero and one. And so if we talk about chi going to very small values, same type of behavior happens as it goes to one, but let's just focus about zero. The distribution basically looks like chi to some power, right? And you're absolutely right. If that power is positive, your distribution goes to zero at zero. But if that power is zero, distribution is flat, right?
Yeah.
And so what Shanika mentioned is the boundaries of her hyperprior, basically what she allows these exponents to be. They run up and they go right as the limiting case to when the distribution is flat. And so this is also referred to as a non-singular beta distribution. And that's because if that exponent is negative, then at zero, your probability density explodes, right? You have a divergence, and that can still be integrable, but there's, you know, people typically avoid that because of issues with sampling and some of the stuff that Shanika was talking about, like the nitty gritty behind the scenes. So, you know, mathematically, yes, uniform distributions are supported by her hyperprior. Maybe they're on the edge and we can argue about whether it's a greater than or equal or just a greater than, right? Whether it's technically in there, but you should be able to get arbitrarily close to a uniform distribution in the analysis that Shanika is doing. But then Shanika's point is that, you know, the data that we have for the population of merging binaries doesn't look like X-ray binaries, right? The spin distribution seems to be distinct. So the beta distribution, like, even though this technically, mathematically would be allowed, it doesn't have any pragmatic effect on most of Shanika's conclusions. Shanika, is that fair? Would you say that that's a fair
distribution? Yes. To clarify, so the beta distribution, and if I've mathematically remembered this correctly, so we restrict alpha and beta chi to be greater than, and I think equal to one. So when it's equal to one, both of these, pretty sure both of them being equal to one is a flat distribution, but this is like at the bounds of our distribution. So like Reed mentioned, this is I'm pretty sure it's just greater than one. So we don't allow exactly for flat, but anything from flat to anything going to, making a shape with my hands here, but like from flat to going from zero to zero at chi equals zero and zero at chi equals one. So there is like a spread for that. But what we see is with our population result, it prefers to have not maximally spinning events. And to add to this, from our gravitational wave data, we don't see a preference for maximally spinning events. Okay. So I completely left out the alpha chi and beta chi information. So thanks again, Reid, for clarifying that.
I think Aman has a question.
Hi, Shanika. Thank you for the nice talk. I had a question about the data. So when you do this analysis, are you assuming, is there any merit in assuming that you have some sort of selection in the data, and so we might have to apply some sort of window function that we are preferentially seeing, you know, low spin binaries, and that's just because we are preferentially, more tuned to that. Is there any merit in thinking that way and applying a window function or something similar?
So do you mean like selection effects of
exactly
referring, like we're seeing more of certain kinds of binaries? So
than the highly spinning ones, yeah.
Yeah, so with, I guess, so there is an aspect to prior to even, you know, doing our population studies and so forth. So we have, and I think Reid is very much working in this stuff, so correct me if I'm wrong, Reid, but with our initial studies, we have some injections that we use to actually do our initial analysis to find these events. And so for these spin analyses, from memory, we used aligned spins, but uniform in spin components. So the only impact, I think, the only thing that we'd be difficult capturing is, or like the selection effect that we're not accounting for as well, is when you have different alignments rather than different spin magnitudes. However, in GWTC2, we did do a small study seeing if these are like this restriction of aligned spins is going to impact our results greatly in terms of our result in spin misalignments and precession. However, what we found is this restriction is actually making a very little difference, and in some cases making our estimates more conservative. That's what I'm remembering from GWTC2, although I might have to check a few other details. But from my understanding at this stage, this is not making just having these aligned spins is not making any big difference to our analyses. So we're not really biased.
Okay, so basically, if I understand correctly, the selection effect comes from the alignment, assumption about the alignment of the spins, but that selection effect is negligible. That's what you have seen.
So what we haven't accounted for is, like, because we're assuming aligned spins for our original injections for this population, the bias would come from that, because we know that the events we're looking at are not perfectly aligned. So, but what we find is this bias is very, very small from what I remember from the GWTC2 analysis. Although, Reid, if you wanted to jump in and comment on that, feel free if you're still around. But
yeah, I mean, so what Shanika is saying is right, that the effect that spins have on sort of the detectability of your system in a population sense is pretty small. Like, it's quantifiable, you can see it, you don't need some fancy statistic, like you just make a histogram and you'll see it, but it's order of percent or two. It's not like 50 or 60%. And there are a couple things that come into it. We think that we did a better job in GDBTC3, which Shanika said, you know, people are looking at that now, but that's kind of a technical detail. The one thing that's worth noting is that large align spins are actually more detectable than like zero spins. So if, like Juan was asking, you know, if there were nearly extremal spins, like we have estimates from X-ray binaries, we are actually preferentially more able to detect those. So at least for part of the conclusions where, you know, we don't see anything that seems to be super highly spinning and aligned, the selection effects are actually like reconfirming that bit of the conclusion. But Aman, your question is well taken. There's at least 6 degrees of freedom in these parameter spaces, right? Two vectors. So it's a lot to keep in your head.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other question for Shanigar? Well, if not, let's thank Shanigar again.